Neil Delamere's Sunday Best. Today
FM. We'll have a look at the front pages of the papers today. You would have heard it on the news there, the gunning down of yet another person in the Kinahan-Hutch feud features in a lot of the papers today. The Sunday World, very startling headline, a very bleak, blasted to death is the headline there. The a third nephew of Jerry the Monk Hutch was gunned down yesterday. The paper tells us this feud seems to continue unabated. The Sindo, a brazen murder amid Hutch trial. Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan outraged at contempt for law and order. Of course, the Regency Hotel shooting trial is on at the moment as well. The victim is the first feud victim of 2018. He's believed to be Derek Coakley Hutch, and he was shot as he sat in a vehicle at the Bridgeview halting site on Clover Hill Road in Clondalkin. The Irish Sun on Sunday, Shoe Donut. This is a reference to a runner thought to have been left behind at the scene by one of the attackers, and the Gardaí obviously hope it will lead to the arrest of the people involved. The Sunday Times front page, Fine Gael at odds over legal advice on abortion poll. Catherine Noone, who's the senator who chaired the Oireachtas Committee on the question, and she has questioned the Attorney's General advice to the government. It seems the advice that the Oireachtas Committee got was that the simplest option was to just repeal the article involved, whereas the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, is expected to tell Cabinet that the preferred option is to repeal the Eighth Amendment and replace it with an enabling clause designed to immunise future abortion legislation against constitutional challenges in the Supreme Court. So conflicting advice, it seems, there. There's a picture on the front page, and it's featured in, well, the story's featured in a lot of papers today. Picture on the front page of the Sunday Times of Mary Lou MacDonald, fist aloft in triumph. Very Black Panthers altogether. She was confirmed yesterday, you'll have heard by now, as the only candidate in the race to replace Gerry Adams as the Sinn Féin party president. Sunday Business Post, revenue issues stark warning on EU tax plan. And above that in red, it says jobs, taxes, investment. The impact of the EU's new digital tax plan on Ireland is laid bare in new documents drafted by the Revenue Commissioners, which warns us, and well, warns the state anyway, that it will lead to multinational job losses here and a substantial fall off in corporate tax and payroll receipts. Under this new EU digital plan, tech companies like your Googles and your Facebooks, they will be taxed on their actual sales in each EU country rather than at the registered EU headquarters, which tend to be here in Dublin. Bad news for us as a smaller nation, obviously, with a small market. And finally, for the moment, the Irish Mail on Sunday. Brother accused of abuse was left in Africa. Michael Farrell has the story there about the religious order that allowed a school principal to work and live with vulnerable children in Africa, even as payouts were made to his Irish accusers. We'll take a look at some of these stories and more. We're joined now by Ellen Coyne of the Times Ireland edition. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Let's start, if I could start with the Sunday, Sunday Independent. And as I said, that murder yesterday in Clondalkin is their lead. But also what caught my eye on top, the very first thing you see when you see the paper is the very top story there in terms of a topographical layout, I suppose you could say. The very poignant description by Maeve Sheehan of the funeral of baby John, of the Kerry baby case in 1984. A very poignant description there by Maeve.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece. I think Maeve actually, by the sounds of it, went back down to Cathair Sibhín, the small community in South Kerry, which has obviously been completely shaken again this week with the case re-emerging. So she has some really beautiful details there about a local undertaker, Tom Kernan, who actually was brought down after the baby was found, who baptised him, and he was the person who named him Baby John. And he's just detailing how he felt that this child needed a better standard of a funeral rather than a quiet one just attended by him and a local guard. So he organised what actually ended up being a massive guard of honour from all the local schools. Obviously, this happened, it didn't happen that long ago, but when you actually go back and look at the details of this case, it may as well have been medieval. So Maeve talks about how this community is trying to come to grips with this tragedy. Again, a lot of the people there still remember it very well. A lot of people are still quite traumatised by it. And also, I mean, you have details in other papers, like Nell McCafferty, who actually wrote a book at the time, is kind of summarising it in the Sunday Business Post. And I was actually reading it myself last night, and we all know the crux of the scandal, but you forget the details. Like, at one stage, the guards in Kerry were trying to hunt a man called Tom Flynn because they found his name on Joanne Hayes's mattress and was convinced she was sleeping around with him. He was the man who made the mattresses and had emigrated when Joanne was like 10 years old. And I know this is a horrific story. I mean, the way that child was killed was very violent. But you actually look at the social context. This is at a time where it was almost impossible to get contraception in that part of Kerry because all the pharmacists had a conscientious objection to it. At the time, there was at least three concealed pregnancies around the Cahir's Eivin area. There was the pregnancy of baby John himself, a woman who'd given birth without anybody knowing, social welfare or the guards. And then there was Joanne Hayes's pregnancy, which was concealed as well when her baby died. So I think you have to look at that as a bit of an anomaly as well. The fact that this was such a common problem in Ireland in the early 80s, that women were giving birth to children without anybody knowing.
Yeah, it really affected the Undertaker as well. He's 88 now, even after all these years. And there was the destruction of the gravestone he'd put at the grave, and he just couldn't understand that senseless act towards an innocent child. And there's little evidence left at this stage. The Gardaí are looking to the community for help.
Yeah, I mean, that is difficult because at this stage you would wonder how much more information you'd be able to access at this stage in time. But then I suppose on the other hand, as we know from, well, probably not from the tribunal, but with the benefit of hindsight and Joanne's apology, the guards obviously made a bit of a hames of it at the time. They clearly weren't looking for anyone else because once Joanne was identified as somebody who had given birth to somebody who was the product of a married man, they didn't really seem to be looking for anyone else.
Yeah, the tribunal details as well, apart from the fact that the entire Hayes family confessed to something that they clearly didn't do, she testified for longer than any witness in Irish legal history, and her sexual history was brought up. She was had to be sedated while she was giving evidence. The cold case team has been put together with some sort of sensitivity this time. It's gendered balanced, it's looking for community help in terms of testing for DNA. The contrast to the Gardaí at the time couldn't be more pronounced, reading some of the descriptions of the way Joanne Hayes and her family were treated at the time.
I mean, it's once you're reading it, you'd actually almost get the sense that it's something that could fill like a 10-part Netflix documentary series. From the forced confessions to the way she was treated at the tribunal, there's an amazing picture in the Sunday Business Post of her walking out of the tribunal looking pretty traumatised, and she's absolutely laden down with bouquets of flowers from the Tralee Women's Group, which kind of came to her support once the public became... I mean, we cast the Ireland in the 1980s as some place that was very harsh to women, as some place that was very aggressive, and obviously the authorities were, the tribunal was, the guards were, but I don't think we should forget that there was actually a lot of horror from the Irish public at the time as well, and a lot of sympathy towards Joanne once it became clear exactly what her family had been through.
Yeah, I am Tom Flynn. People were wearing t-shirts
Absolutely.
Saying I am Tom Flynn, so people were demonstrating their support. Pat Rabbit has, just to kind of contextualise this, has a very interesting article on page 7 of the Sunday Business Post as well, and he's talking about just the time and who was influential at the time, and it's a lot of it is about Archbishop John Charles McQuaid. The end paragraph strikes me. Cut off completely from the Catholic thought of our time in Europe, we enjoyed a stagnant peace of a backwater, which is what a Jesuit priest wrote in 1955. It was this stagnant peace that created the circumstances that allowed the scandal of the Kerry babies to happen. This is a time to maintain perspective. Yeah, and so say all of us, and hopefully this mystery after so many years, hopefully the guards will crack something in the case in the next while, whether it be through people coming forward with DNA results or whatever else. I want to move on because I want to get your take on a couple of stories from the Sunday Times, because you're a person who works for an online publication, so you're familiar with that world. What do you make of the front page? US companies lobbied government for the digital age of consent here to be 13.
Yeah, really interesting story by Colin Coyle there on the front. The American Chamber of Commerce, which represents like your Facebooks, your Googles, your Twitters, lobbied the government to lower the digital age of consent from 16 to 13. Now, it was lowered to 13, but we can't say it was because of their lobbying.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't understand, that means that you would basically need, if you were 13 years old, you wouldn't need your parent to consent if you were using an app that collected your information. And the argument was that if it was 16, if the age of consent was 16, children under 13 would have their kind of free speech restricted, people who were savvy enough anyway would be able to fake their age and make it 16. But I mean, if you read on in this story, there's a lot of evidence from people like Europol, maybe agencies that work with children who've been sexually abused online, who are just saying that unless you have a super compelling argument, rather than just, you know, maybe free speech might be restricted, it's always better to err on the side of caution when you're dealing with children.
Yeah, and I think what they're trying to say as well is that unless you have data that you can point to then, as you say, err on the side of caution, because what do we lose about this? It concludes tech-savvy teenagers would simply lie about their age if the limit were set at 16. I mean, that's, you know, not necessarily a reason to set it at 13. Kids might lie about their age when they're buying booze. It doesn't mean you should let them do it at a younger age, necessarily. Yeah. But as you said, you can lobby the government. I mean, this is the point of an open consultation, and that's not necessarily why they set it at 13. What is the general rule across Europe?
The general rule across Europe is that 16 is a kind of guideline, but member states do have the power to lower it to 13 if they want to. I mean, my own view would be that collecting the data of people who are aged 13, 14 and 15 wanting to do that and wanting the right to do that, to me, does just sound a little bit nefarious. I don't know what the benefit of that could be. And I think when you balance the possible damage against the benefit, okay, 13-year-olds would have super specific targeted ads sent to them, but the risk that you're opening people up to by making their presence online legally validated from the age of 13, I think, I mean, it's pretty obvious to all of us what could happen there.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you say, the EU default at 16, but we, along with some other countries, have set it to 13 because you're allowed to do that as an individual member state. Sticking with this general area, page 13 of the Sunday Times details the number of times the emergency services, now this is in the UK, but I think we can probably extrapolate it out a little bit. I don't think we're as bad here, to be honest with you, but it's given the number of times the emergency services have had to respond to people who do stupid things for YouTube and stunts, and it is in the UK, but the figures are instructive.
Yeah, I mean, the taxpayer emergency services in the UK have seen a 2/3 increase over the last 5 years in the number of call-outs they've had for accidents and crimes that have happened because people have been just doing stupid things on YouTube for attention. And I mean, in last year... So it would be people standing on top of trains, standing on top of elevators. There was one case of a guy training his girlfriend's dog to do a Nazi salute. He was charged with a hate crime. This is all for views on YouTube and probably linked to the last story. I mean, one of the kind of aspirational careers that children have now that we didn't have, without sounding super ancient, is to be a YouTuber or a blogger. And in the absence of any specific skill or quality or charm to get to actually merit that kind of career, you can't just start doing stupid, terrible things and get a huge amount of attention for it. So this probably appeals to a lot of people. And I mean, in 2017 alone, the emergency services had almost 3,000 call-outs for incidents like this, where people had either put their own lives at risk or had broken like a hate crime just for attention online.
Yeah, I would suggest the use of the phrase super ancient means that you're not super ancient, by the way, so I think you're okay there. And we also draw the distinction between teaching your dog to do something stupid like that, hate crime or not, and causing the emergency services to come to the scene of something where they could be helping somebody else. For example, that idiot who put his head into a microwave and set polyfill in it and basically figured out then after a while that it set and he couldn't breathe and he had to get the fire brigade to come and cut him out.
And he was rightly publicly shamed for it.
Yes, yeah. It does make that point that that you're bringing people away, the emergency services away from somebody who might genuinely be in need and didn't put themselves in need on purpose. YouTube, it should be pointed out, owned by Google, makes a lot of money from this as well, though.
It makes hundreds of millions. We don't know the exact figure, but they take about a 40% take from people who monetize their videos. No, anybody who is putting their lives at risk, obviously it's not worth it, but they do often monetize those videos to try and make a lot from it. So you would have to wonder, while YouTube is profiting so much, is it going to be minded to crack down on it that much?
Yeah. Page 16 of the Irish Sun on Sunday. Let me move on. It is a Sunday morning. Do you drink, do you partake of wine?
I drink wine as if it's going out of fashion, as if there's some like blight raging through all the red grapes in France.
Well, the red grapes specifically. But in the Walking Dead dystopian future, you could be pushed to drink white. On page 16 of the Irish Sun on Sunday, it has, well, something that you might be interested in, something that would take the sulfites out of wine. What is it?
So I was so excited when I saw this story, because basically there's this new product which takes the sulfites out of wine by kind of filtering it. It's like it looks like a little egg cup that you put in the top of your glass and pour the wine through. Now, these sulfites are things that you naturally get in grapes, but a lot of winemakers will add loads to the bottle to make sure it like lasts longer. Basically the claim is that if you filter these things out, you'll be able to drink all the wine that you wanted without getting a hangover, which is obviously incredibly appealing to me, because the hangover and the like red wine teeth on a date are like the two only downsides of wine.
Well, I think they're saying that it can affect some people worse than others, but it's not the thing in the alcohol that actually causes you your hangover.
It's a tenuous claim, but it would be one that I would certainly be willing to try.
Won't everybody try this? Because we are determined not to pay the price. We will not pay the ferryman or the piper or whatever for having a good time. And we have tried charcoal filters and drips and diurnal lights and all those things. And people will try this, won't they?
We'll do absolutely anything. I think it's, I mean, we'll look past all of the flaws of alcohol to keep our relationship with it.
A warm relationship, but I love it.
Yeah.
And you're right, Ireland is the fourth largest consumer of this particular product, this little polymer, in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, I was obviously willing to go out and buy this immediately once I got to the third paragraph of this story. And the journalist, Deirdre Reynolds, does conclude that she woke up the next day surprisingly fresh without a hint of a hangover, so I was ready to go on Amazon straight away. But then she pointed out that she only drank half a bottle. So obviously, sure, I could do that anyway from the neck of the bottle and I still wouldn't get a hangover.
There's an image of you on a stairs somewhere crying into a bottle of red wine. God, it doesn't really matter anymore.
My normal Saturday nights.
Very briefly, because time is against us. Did you see the article at page 3 of the Irish Mail on Sunday? It's about a programme on tomorrow night on RTÉ detailing what we eat in a year. Quickly, if you don't mind, is there anything in particular that jumped out at you from that?
Yeah, so we're doing 15 million cups of tea every day, which is a lot. But what they point out as well is that that's three times the amount of cups of coffee. So despite the spread of all our Starbucks and our kind of trendy places it's still tea dominating every household in the country.
Yeah, we'll try and open a cappuccino or a skinny flat white out of a flask at a GAA match around the country. I think tea will reign supreme for another while longer. My thanks to Ellen Coyne there.
Neil Delamere's Sunday Best. Today FM.